In a time of crisis, the Red Cross meets the immediate disaster cause needs of people and communities. The recent campfire saw the Red Cross mobilized to be one of the first organizations to reach the area. Gary Strong, CEO of the Gold Country Region, joins us in partnership with the American Leadership Forum to talk about the experience. Next on Studio Sacramento.
At Five Star Bank, we create thoughtful solutions to help the Capital Region thrive, from economic development and education to public health and safety, issues that are vitally important to Sacramento's prosperity. We're proud to be part of the conversation and hope you'll join in.
You know, my mother used to say a long time ago, whenever there would be any really catastrophe that was in the movies or on the air, she would say, always look for the helpers. There will always be helpers, you know, even just on the sidelines. That's why I think that if news programs could make a conscious effort of showing rescue teams, of showing who medical people, anybody who is coming into a place where there's a tragedy, to be sure that they include that. Because if you look for the helpers, you'll know that there's hope.
I love that. Is there a better description of the Red Cross than that, Gary?
There really isn't. That really is who we are and what we do at the Red Cross. So love that clip.
When the Red Cross comes in, for most of us, we think of hope. We know that there's a huge physical and material component, but describe to us what you all bring beyond the food, the blankets, and the shelters.
Well, we bring a lot. And when you say beyond the food, the blankets, and the shelter, that's not trivial itself. When we just had these last fires, the campfire up in Paradise, we brought truckloads, tractor trailer loads of cots, of blankets, of items that people need for their hygiene and such. But more importantly, we also brought the people that were needed to support those who were affected by the disaster. We have trained nurses. People escape from their homes, they're running quickly, they don't have their medicines. We have nurses that are there that can get their prescriptions filled. You can imagine people are lost. They don't know what their future is going to be like. It really does a number on their head. We have trained mental health workers as well that'll be there for those folks. So we give them some certainty in a time when things are really uncertain.
It leads me to wonder this. Mm-hmm. We all expect the Red Cross, non-governmental entity, funded by, you know, a lot of philanthropy and things like that. We expect you to be there like our fire department, our police department, our clergy, whoever. And what would life be like in like the disasters that we've recently experienced in California, the fires, without the Red Cross's presence?
Yeah, well, you're absolutely right. You say we're not a governmental entity, but we do have a congressional charter. The Congress of the United States, way back in the beginning of the 20th century, decided that the Red Cross was going to have the responsibility to respond in the case of disasters. So we have that responsibility. We are going to be there. And because of that, we are prepared. We've done all of the work that needs to be done beforehand so that when the need is there, we can get there, hit the ground running, and take care of things. What we often find in disasters is that there's a lot of well-meaning people. They want to help out. They'll open up a shelter independently. They'll find out very quickly that it's not a trivial thing to open up a shelter, that you need to have people that know what they're doing, and we have those people.
When the campfire first started, how did you find out about it?
Well, I first found out about it as I was leaving for work early that Thursday morning. I got a text, and the text said that there was a fire up in Butte County. It was in an unpopulated area, and that there was a desire for shelters to be opened up. Happened to be very windy day, red flag warnings, and we always know when there are red flag warnings that there's going to be a fire. So it really didn't hit me that hard when I saw that. I figured it probably isn't going to be much, not by a populated area. By the time I got to work, I went online, and CAL FIRE has this great mapping system where you can see exactly where a fire stands, how many acres are involved, what the containment is. And still by then, about 9 o'clock, it still did not look that troubling. So I went off to interview a board member, and I was there for about 2 hours. By the time I came back to the office, my phone was blowing up with texts. This thing had really, it had hit the populated area, and it was really wreaking havoc, and we knew that it was going to be big. And that shows how the Red Cross can jump in and act very quickly. Because in that scant 2 hour period of time, by the time I got back to the office, my disaster folks were already on the phone with people from our national headquarters in Washington, D.C., who had also realized how big this was going to be and had started to mobilize equipment, materials, and people to really serve those folks.
From all the way across the United States?
The communication was happening from across the United States because we put our top disaster person in the nation in charge of running the initial part of this event. But the immediate response has to be local, right? Because people are being evacuated. They're told they need to leave their homes and they need a place to go. So we have local volunteers that are around and they're there for those folks immediately.
Well, what I'm really getting at mm-hmm. is that the materials that you bring in to help people, they don't all come from just the local area. They come from across the country?
They can. We have enough material spread throughout our region. We have a very large region here. It's about 44,000 square miles. And we'll have trailers that will have materials for a disaster and for an evacuation if it happens. Usually those evacuations are small, 100, 200 people. We can roll a small trailer and take care of them. It gets to be bigger than that, we go to more of a regional warehousing system. So in Reno, we have a very large warehouse that covers much of the western United States. So within those 2 hours, that's when we had those tractor trailers rolling from Reno to provide those goods.
And when you go into a disaster zone like that, mm-hmm. give us kind of a window in on what happens in which order in order to address the immediate needs on the ground.
Yeah, so the first and most important thing is to have a shelter that you can open up. Again, all of this happens well before the disaster happens. You don't show up at a disaster and start from scratch. We have a network of facilities that we've reached agreements with where we know where they are, we know what their capabilities are, their capacities are, and we have the agreements with the owners of those facilities, whether they be churches or they could be gyms or what have you. So we have those agreements in place so that then we can go and open the doors immediately and we can be there before the evacuees even get there. So that's the first thing. You open the doors, have a place for the people to show up to, have someone to welcome there, sign them in, and start to congregate. Then the cots and all of those materials that will have to come from outside of the area, those will follow. But we would expect that if we have a disaster that starts in the daytime, by 4 hours, you're gonna have all of those things in place. So we're calling up volunteers, getting them to come to the scene because it takes really an army of folks to be able to manage a large evacuation. In this case, you know, over 1,000 people the first night that we were sheltering.
What are conditions like on the ground right now in the area of the campfire?
So if you look at Paradise, the city of Paradise is gone. It has been completely wiped out. There are structures there, but for all intents and purposes, it is not livable or habitable. The homes that are there, people are not able to really live there because of the toxic waste associated with all of the homes that have melted, heavy metals, leads and such. So because of that, it's still pretty much off limits. You have some people that are camping on their home sites, but they're being asked to move out as well so that they can start the cleanup process so that you can start moving people back in and starting to do construction. Tough thing about losing a town like that with that many people we were already in a situation in that part of the state where vacancies were incredibly low. There's no place for them to go. So a lot of people have had to move to relatives that are far away, including out of state. And there are people that are still in shelters. We are just getting close now to wrapping up our sheltering activities. It's almost 3 months in, and we still have folks in those shelters because they have no place else to go.
Is 3 months an unusually long time?
Absolutely. A typical fire, you will find that people would be sheltered for the extent of the fire and then maybe a couple of weeks after that, because you can start to find places for them to go, whether it's rentals or other places. But in this case, it was so many people that were displaced, you know, some 20, 30,000 people displaced, nowhere for them to go. If you have resources, you can find a place to go. If you have family, you can find family to go to. But the people that really are the ones that stay in our shelters for very long extended periods of time are the people that don't have any other alternative. So those are the ones now that we've had for months on end. Yeah.
And we heard about people in places like Walmart parking lots.
Yes.
And that it actually, so many people were camped out that it became a bit of an issue.
It did.
What is it that leads people to gravitate to areas like that? And then how is it that you work with your colleagues in FEMA and Office of Emergency Services and that sort of thing in order to get people at least someplace where they can be truly stable for a while?
Sure. So we live, our region that we cover, like I said, is a large region, but it covers anything from, you know, city folks that you have here in Sacramento to people that are mountain folks.
Incidentally,
yes.
Don't you lose your train of thought. Mm-hmm. Give us a sense of the breadth of your region.
Sure. So if you start at the bottom of our region, it's Stanislaus County, up to the Oregon border, and then over to the Nevada line. So about a third of the state of California is our region. And just knowing that geography, I bet you can understand how there are different types of people that are living throughout that geography. Some people are people that are comfortable living in cities, living close to other people. Others are living up in those northern parts of the state because they want to have separation from their neighbors, separation from others. And they don't like to be hemmed in. So we open shelters. That's our natural way to bring people together, to put a roof over their head. But if you're a type of person that doesn't like to be hemmed in, you're not going to want to be in a big gym that has another 300 people in there with a cot right next to you. You're going to want to have some space. Plus, what we find often is that for most people, pets are very important to them. For some, pets are their family. And you can't really have pets inside of a shelter. We'd like to, but who knows what's going to happen there. You have people with allergies, pets that might not get along well together. So what we'll do is work with partners to have a pet shelter that will be adjacent to our shelters for the humans, so that the owners can meet with their pets and walk them and enjoy them. But some, that's not enough. Some need to have the pets with them, sleeping next to them, so they're gonna stay out in a tent outside. If they have an RV or access to an RV, they're going to use that. And that's a lot of what you found in that Walmart parking lot. In fact, even with our shelter, at the Silver Dollar Fairgrounds, the final shelter that we've had left open, if you were to look a month ago, you would find that there were about 200 people that were inside the shelter, but about 500 people on the shelter ground, either in tents or in RVs, because they wanted to have their space.
How is it that you at the Red Cross coordinate with the other governmental disaster respondents, you know, local police and fire, FEMA, OES, and others? How does that system come together?
Yeah, it is a system, and it is a very comprehensive one that includes not only these government agencies, but there's also other not-for-profits that are involved. And all of us work on our planning well ahead of time so that we know what each organization's role is going to be and what they're going to bring to the party. By each of us knowing what our piece is, we're able to come together very smoothly. In any disaster, the Red Cross has a rule that we do not self-deploy. We don't see that a disaster's out there and decide that we're going to go save the day. That's not what we're all about. That ownership sits at the County Office of Emergency Services, and in a larger event, it would be the State Office of Emergency Services as well. So they will be watching the event, they'll get the call, and then they'll reach out to us and let us know the manpower and the shelter facilities that are needed. Once that happens and it gets big like Camp Fire, you get a federal declaration, that's when FEMA will come in. FEMA coming in really changes the scene in that they are a source of money for the people whose homes have been destroyed. And that is a very helpful thing and helps move people more quickly to a resolution because they're there to provide that funding. The other partners that we work with, the Salvation Army is almost always with us from the very beginning as the feeding group. They roll as quickly as we do. They're on site. They're preparing food that we can then go ahead and serve to the people there in the shelter. Another group that has recently joined us is World Central Kitchen. When the Salvation Army is there for a few weeks and this thing becomes an extended response, World Central Kitchen, which is run by a celebrity chef that has notoriety for being out in Puerto Rico.
Jose Andres.
Jose Andres, exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes, he does a terrific job, and he will come in, and he has actually been with us through his coordinated team for about the last 2 months working on the response here.
What do you consider, mm-hmm. as you survey the area, to be the long-term issues that these communities are going to have to wrestle with in order to put themselves back together again?
Well, it all starts with that whole vacancy rate that we talked about earlier. And that's the biggest long-term issue, I believe, because you can get in there, you can start the cleanup, you can get the grounds prepared, but it is going to be a while before you can get the permits pulled, get the approvals you need, then start construction. I mean, if you look back at Santa Rosa, that was over a year ago now, and very few homes have been built there. And in order to do that building, in this particular case, in the Chico area, without that vacancy, there's no place for builders to live and stay so that they can do that work. Already a shortage of builders because of the people working in the other disaster areas, and I think that's going to be the biggest challenge in putting that city back together.
You referenced Santa Rosa,
mm-hmm.
And sometimes the public's mind and memory is pretty short.
Sure.
In the last, say, 2 to 3 years, just ballpark, how many disasters have you all been deployed on?
Well, I would say for the last 2 years, it has almost been nonstop disaster deployment. We talked a little bit earlier about equipment and people being moved from across the country. One of the strengths of the Red Cross is that it is a national organization. So we respond to things that happen on the East Coast. We raise money for things that happen on the East Coast, and the same them for us. So if you look at I'll just go back to July because that's what's freshest in mind for me. We had the car fire that was up in the Redding area. That was a big response for us to deal with. Very soon after that, there was Hurricane Florence. Right after that, there was Hurricane Michael. Then there was the Camp Fire. We also had down in Hawaii the volcano eruption that they were dealing with, the lava flow, which is a long-running type of disaster that had people in shelters for up to 6 months. Now, the local folks cannot be there and help out the people that are affected there for that long a period of time, so we had to bring people from our area to go help them out there. There have been typhoons in the South Pacific, so it really has been nonstop for the last couple of years.
Is it your sense that the number of natural disasters is multiplying within, a given time frame? Or is this kind of, it's an ebb and flow thing over the years?
Yeah, it's hard to tell. It could be an ebb and flow, but what we are noticing, though, is the wildland-urban interface is getting closer and closer and more narrow, such that when you do have fires, if you look back 50 years, we probably had fires as frequently as we do now, but those fires were allowed to burn because they weren't affecting people. But now the wildlands are so close to where people are living that when there is a fire, it has much more traumatic impacts and a need for us to respond.
Going back to the campfire, mm-hmm. recently we had a gentleman who lived in the area mm-hmm. with his family, was a teacher, and lost his home. Mm-hmm. And he remarked that he felt that the biggest challenge that was going to face that community was the fact that a significant number of these people would never be able to move back, because the time frame of addressing the issue that you just raised related to reconstructing homes and all of that was going to take would be so long mm-hmm. that essentially, one, there was no infrastructure to build on, but two, just the time frame would force people to leave, and it was the devastation and elimination of whole communities
right.
permanently.
Right.
What is it that the public, after the cameras leave, don't understand about areas trying to rebuild themselves after a disaster?
Well, I think it's just like you said, that that it does take a very long time. I mentioned Santa Rosa. Santa Rosa was a more affluent community than what we find up in the Paradise and Butte County area. It was a younger community. What you'll find is if you look at our shelter residents, they skew dramatically towards the older and towards the poorer. And those are people that, even if they do get compensation from FEMA or from the Red Cross, they have to really take a look at whether or not it even makes sense to try to start over at their stage in life.
When the Red Cross gets ready to pull out, is there a transition that takes place? Is there a formal handoff that happens? Or is it just sort of an organic thing where you guys kind of see it and know that your work is done?
Yeah, so our work does not really end when you think it might end. If you look at the whole concept of pulling out, is one that we're right in the middle of right now. I told you about a month ago we had, you know, several hundred people in the shelter. As of this date that we're speaking now, February 5th, we are down to about 25 people in the shelter. So been making a lot of progress in moving people to their next stage. How you get people to their next stage is that we've flown in a number of caseworkers that are very skilled, experienced, have been through it before, who will sit down and have meetings with these individuals and families and gain a good understanding of what the barriers truly are for them to make their next stage in their life or their next steps. So we'll look to provide items or money or whatever it might take to help them break down those barriers. Some it might be that, you know, I'll be okay, but I need the first couple of months rent to be able to get by. You'll do that. I'm going to live with a family member that's out of state, but I don't have a plane ticket. We'll get the plane ticket. We'll move them on that way. So that all happens. But the thing that is interesting about the way disasters work, when they're big, sexy disasters like a fire that's all over the news and people see, the community becomes very generous and they give a lot of funds to help support the response to that disaster. That was the case in the campfire. Community gave a lot. It was enough for us to be able to cover the cost of our immediate service that we gave to the evacuees, but also then it leaves more money that we can give them to help them make those next transitions. On top of that, it also leaves money for what we would call long-term recovery. And we have a couple of people that are focused on that long-term recovery, which could be 2, 3, 4, 5 years that the Red Cross will stay with this disaster, helping those individuals with cash awards, as well as helping build the infrastructure.
And briefly, we do focus on the big disaster parts of your mission. Mm-hmm. Briefly, could you just share with us what are the other parts of your mission and what you do that the public's generally unaware of?
Right. So big disasters everyone knows about. In reality, if you look at the scope of our work in a particular year, the big disasters may be a couple of months, 3 months that we're working on it. For the rest of the time, we're working on mainly everyday little disasters. So we respond to home fires in our community, in our region, about twice a day, every day of the year. What people don't know is that when an individual's home catches on fire and it looks like it's going to be destroyed, the fire department gets on the phone, calls up the Red Cross, we wake up a volunteer out of the bed, and they come to the site and immediately hand over money to the victim of the home fire so that they can have a place to stay for the next few nights. We give them information about mental health that mental health resources that they may need to make use of. And we're doing that all day, every day. That is a huge part of what we're doing. The other piece, though, just recently, over the last 4 years, I would say, is we've been trying to get more out in front of the disasters, these small disasters. Instead of coming and giving money after the fact and helping people towards their transition, we want to keep it from happening in the first place. And one of the ways that we do that is by installing smoke alarms in people's homes. People don't know, but the number one killer in disasters throughout America is home fires.
And we're going to leave it there. Fascinating mission. Excellent work.
Right.
And that's our show. Thanks to our guest, and thanks to you for watching Studio Sacramento. I'm Scott Syphax. See you next time right here on KVIE.
Thank you for listening to Studio Sacramento from KVIE Public Television. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please leave us a review on iTunes to help others find it.
At Five Star Bank, we create thoughtful solutions to help the Capital Region thrive, from economic development and education to public health and safety. Issues that are vitally important to Sacramento's prosperity. We're proud to be part of the conversation and hope you'll join in.
All episodes of Studio Sacramento, along with other KVIE programs, are available to watch online at kvie.org/video.